Hi, thanks for coming, everybody. I'm Judge Morris with the Global Business Dialogue, and basically, Jay Eisenstadt's going to be your conductor for this afternoon's session, but just wanted to say a couple of things first. This is not, we've done lots of programs on FTAs over the years, but in a sense, and so has KEI, the Korean Economic Institute, and so has Miller and Chevalier. But in my own mind, this is the second in the series we started last in September for 2010. And it's, that first session, as you know, dealt with the pending FTAs that the U.S. had negotiated but not had considered by Congress. Today we're going to look at something different. We're going to look at how various kind of some countries, and we'll hopefully do programs with others, are looking at the FTA programs for themselves. So much for the trailer for this movie. I do want to make one observation and express a thought, and then we'll introduce Jay Eisenstadt. The observation is that this building that we're in right now is a very impressive building. Why do I say that? Well, first and foremost, it's the home of the Korean Economic Institute, which is both an impressive institution in its own right, and it's also been enormously helpful to GBD over the years. It's a real pleasure to work with Troy and his colleagues, and I can't thank them enough for making this really fantastic facility available today. It's also the home of the Transatlantic Business Dialogue. This is a commercial, because we have a program tomorrow, and this one actually will be at 1 o'clock, downstairs in the basement, on that's a continuation of the discussion on raw materials. And perhaps most famously, this building is the home of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's a very lucky place. I say that because they've succeeded in getting, in snagging our own Meredith Broadbent to join their ranks. Starting Monday, she'll be working there, succeeding Grant Aldonis as the holder of the Scholl Chair in International Business. So I hope you'll all be. We will miss her. Okay, so then finally the thought, which has already leaked out a little bit, which is just to say thanks to everybody, to you for coming, to the speakers, to KEI, and to Miller and Chevalier. As the agenda declares, and I've said already, Jay Eisenstadt, who is of counsel with Miller and Chevalier, will be your guide. My rule of thumb in terms of looking at resumes, people, and so forth, is that you want the folks who really do the detail stuff, because that's where things matter. I tend to be in the I wouldn't use this improper word here, but at the BS level of life. But the people who do the real work are the ones I admire. And Jay's been doing the detail stuff for a while now. He was director of customs affairs at USTR. At Miller and Chevalier, he works on and advises clients on issues like CTPAT and CSI. If you don't know what they mean, ask him. He can tell you. Reading his bio, one line in particular caught my attention. This was that he provides counsel to companies and foreign governments seeking to utilize preference programs and FTAs. It would be nice if he had more of those to advise about, but that's another matter. In any case, he's your guide now. Jay, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Judge. I appreciate the opportunity to moderate this important panel. Actually, our firm's relationship with GBD goes back a number of years, and ironically, the first panel that we did, or at least one of the early ones, was on quite a similar topic on free trade agreements and their variants. So I'm happy to be affiliated with the firm and affiliated with GBD in this important discussion. I'll introduce the speakers and the panelists in just a second, but first, just a word to echo Judge's appreciation for Troy making KEI's facilities available. It's really one of the preeminent organizations, pro-trade organizations in D.C., And certainly on the Chorus FTA, there's perhaps no more eloquent spokesman for its benefits than Troy around town, and we all, at least those of us in the pre-trade, in the free trade camp, appreciate all of his work and want to do what we can to support the agreement and its hopeful ratification at the earliest possible date. Before introducing each of the panelists, I wanted to just offer a few remarks to sort of frame today's timely and important discussion. When you ask a government official what they think the most important major trade issue is, they're bound to tell you the Doha Round is the most important issue. But when you ask them what's the most dynamic and active part of your trade agenda, that certainly is not going to meet with the same response, and in fact, it's almost certain not to. The FTA agenda is the answer that you'll get, that it's the proliferation of FTAs, the pursuit of preferential trade agreements on a bilateral and regional level that are their most the most active part of their trade portfolios. So then the focus of today's discussion is how three major economies, Korea, Australia, and the European Union, approach bilateral and regional FTAs, which have become the most active part of these regions' trade liberalization efforts, especially given, or perhaps because of, the moribund state of the Doha Round negotiations. Oddly, at least in the sense that this meeting is being held in Washington and the focus is not per se U.S. trade policy, but the focus is on trade policy of our leading trading partners. And that's because their aggressive pursuit of trade agreements, either bilateral or regional, don't involve the U.S. and the risks that that poses to U.S. economic growth. The underlying question really is, what's driving the proliferation of these FTAs and these regional agreements, both in Asia and involving Europe? In the background is the awareness of the fact that the U.S. appears to be very much an outlier in its approach to global trade generally and to trade liberalization in Asia in particular, which is such an important source of current export revenue and potential export growth for U.S. manufacturers, ranchers, innovators, and investors. A couple of editorialisms here, if you will. America's current antipathy and really outright antagonism towards free trade is a perilous indicator that Americans are looking inward for their economic salvation, when in fact the growth of the U.S. economy and most importantly job growth depends on our ability to compete in the global marketplace and to create competitive advantages for U.S. goods and services in foreign markets that they don't currently enjoy. U.S. economic and job growth is at a great competitive disadvantage because the U.S. has fallen behind other major developed and developing countries, particularly those in Asia, in the pursuit of these new markets, while our trading partners are entering into FTAs that effectively lock U.S. exports out of these markets. And this was perhaps most recently dramatically underscored by yesterday's front page journal article entitled American Sour on Trade, which documented both the U.S. inactivity in trade and also the sort of souring of American opinion, documenting the steep decline in support for free trade among Americans. At the same time, it's both revealing and sobering to know that, you know, until just recently, until the U.S. embarked on its negotiation, the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, the U.S. really risked becoming increasingly marginalized in the pursuit of free trade in North Asia and Southeast Asia because of the aggressive competitive liberalization efforts among our key Asian trading partners, among APEC countries, the ASEAN. Just a few examples are ASEAN plus 3, plus 6, the P4, and so forth, which, as I said, account for really our highest potential growth markets. A couple of facts to illustrate this. I mean, these are perhaps well known to many of you, but in 2000, there were not one East Asian country had embarked on an FTA or had concluded an FTA with either another Asian country or outside the region. By 2009, according to the Asia Development Bank, there were 109 FTAs, bilateral or regional, that had been concluded between or between East Asian countries, or between an East Asian country and a non-East Asian country. And another 107 are being considered, proposed, or under negotiation. Now, to put these numbers into really stark contrast, the United States is the world's largest economy and one of the top three exporters. But in this important region, the U.S. has only concluded FTAs with two East Asian countries, Singapore and Korea. And Australia is for the purposes of this summary, not what we want included. And only one of those, Singapore, is actually in force. So you can see the enormous competitive disadvantage that U.S. exports are at when they're competing with exports from other countries. And Asia isn't alone. The European Union has been, frankly, more aggressive than the United States has been in proliferating FTAs. Some of them are not particularly high quality, and I can attest to that as a negotiator having pored over them. But the fact of the matter is that they got in to the African market and concluded their FTA with the SACU countries before the U.S. did, and that is a major contributing factor to why the U.S. was not able to conclude its FTA with SACU, because SACU countries had decided that they would only accept the EU template. And the other markets as well, and as recently as yesterday, when the EU decided that it would pursue an FTA with Malaysia. So the U.S. is really, while it's embarked on TPP, and that's an important initiative and has potential, is really operating at a disadvantage and is playing catch-up. And that's really the subject of today's discussion, is to get a better sense regionally of how we're matching up against our key Asian trading partners. And for that, I'd like to get started, and we'll start with Troy Stangerone. Just a couple of factoids about Troy. He's obviously familiar to all of you and a mainstay in the trade policy community in Washington. He's the Director for Congressional and Trade Affairs at KEI and is responsible for KEI's congressional outreach, and he serves as their point person on the CORUS FTA. Early in his career, Troy was on the staff of Senator Robert Torricelli, where he covered foreign affairs and trade issues. And we look forward to Troy's remarks on Korea's recent trade liberalization efforts and trends for the future.
Thank you, Jay. And I'd just like to say thank you to both you and Judge for your very kind remarks about both myself and KEI. To get started, I'd like to use an anecdote, if the judge will indulge me for a moment. I did my master's degree at LSE in London, and I happened to do it during not the last British election, but the 2005 British election. And having worked on the Hill, worked for a member who ran a campaign committee, worked on different campaigns in the U.S., I have to say that the most enlightening an educational experience about U.S. politics was actually working and being involved in a British election. Mm-hmm. And some people might ask, well, why would that be the case? You know, they're different. We'll read a lot in the newspaper about people pontificating about what's going to happen in the U.K. And having lived there, I can tell you most of them are usually wrong because they don't understand how Brits are different from Americans. But the reason I say that is that by working or looking at something that's not like your system, it helps you to understand your system better. Because it makes you think outside the box and take and question assumptions that you have had in the past. So I think that this is a very worthwhile exercise to look at what other people are doing to try and get a better feel for what the United States should be doing or what it isn't doing. So with that being said, I'll move towards talking about Korea, sort of Korea's experience with free trade, and where the Republic of Korea is right now. When I started in this job, one of the most interesting comments that I heard came in probably the first event I ever went to, which was at AEI. And they had, I think at the time, he was the Korean executive director for the IMF. But he was talking about the Korean economy. And the one thing that he talked about was, he said, the problem that Korea has is that essentially we're stuck in the middle and we're about to get collapsed on. Our wages aren't cheap enough to compete with China anymore as a low-wage country, so we're going to get eaten up in manufacturing. And we're not a high-tech service economy to compete with the United States and Japan. So we have to take and reform our economy. And that sort of analogy and point kind of always stuck with me when you think about where Korea is and what they're doing. And You know, if you look at Korea right now, this year they most likely have a per capita GDP of $20,000. So, you know, we're talking about a country that's significantly moving up the wage scales. But if you think about sort of the great Korean companies that we have now, you know, in terms of marketing things, Hyundai and Kia with their essentially job loss insurance program over the last year have been very innovative in terms of marketing and some other things. You know, Samsung and LG, I bet you probably have the people in the room have Samsung phones right now. So Korean companies on the international stage have done very well, and they've done very well in the United States. But if you think about it, I'm hard-pressed to take and find the answer to what is the innovative Korean product that's come out of one of those. Samsung has a hot new phone now called the Galaxy, which some people refer to as an iPhone killer. But the reason the Samsung Galaxy exists is because there were innovative people at Apple who came up with the iPhone, who entered into the smartphone market. So these are sort of the contexts in which, as I go forward, I think we should kind of keep in mind what Korea is trying to do. You know, over the last 60 years, Korea has come a long way. At the end of the Korean War, which we're fortunate to have an exhibition up over here on the wall, of some of the few pictures of the Korean War and actually in color. You know, even up to 10 years after the war, Korea still had a GDP per capita of about $100 a person. So Korea is a very poor country. And it took and it rapidly industrialized in the 70s and 80s. Now, what is relevant about this is that how and why did Korea get to where it was? Korea is primarily an export economy. You know, historically, the number you'll hear about, though, I've seen recently because of the crisis and some changes in currency, make this slightly different. 70% of the Korean economy is related to trade. That's actually up to about 80% right now. But the difficulty Korea has is that it's actually a fairly inefficient economy. Its services sector is extremely inefficient. Overall, the Korean economy, I looked at the OECD numbers today, its services labor productivity is only about 58% of its manufacturing productivity. But at the same time, the overall Korean economy's productivity is only about half of that of the OECD. So you're talking about a country that has very inefficient sectors, agriculture being another one of them, but that has a very, very highly efficient manufacturing sector. Now, one of the other things when I talk about Korea is keep in mind that Korea is a small country, about 50 million people. It's about the size of Indiana, and out of that, it has very little arable land, which means that Korea imports about half of its food. So this is sort of the context in which to view the Korean economy and ask sort of the questions of what would their policymakers be thinking about, what would their goals be, what do they need to do in terms of reaching out. Now, prior to 2003, Korea and Mongolia were the only two members of the WTO who hadn't had an FTA. Korea started its expansion to FTAs with Chile and eventually went on to negotiate with Japan, the United States, and a series of other countries who I'll get into shortly. Now, the Japanese negotiations haven't gone very far. They've actually been suspended for about 6 years now, probably. The reason for that is that while the India FTA probably isn't of high quality as the U.S. FTA is, Korea actually takes and expects to have high-quality agreements. Japan was unwilling to take and negotiate on agriculture, and so the Koreans took and put a stop to it. And until the Japanese show willingness to actually engage on agricultural issues, the Koreans have taken and said that they wouldn't re-engage on those negotiations. Now, when we ask the question, and I only briefly talk about the course FTA in my remarks, why did Korea take and pursue an FTA with the United States? If you look at a lot of the statistics on sort of the results from the FTA, contrary to what some people in the auto industry might say, the one question that you'll find a Korean official often gets asked is, why did you want this FTA? The U.S. gets more out of it. The ITC study puts, and while I know they would take and say, don't do what I'm about to do, essentially says that, you know, the U.S. gets about a $4 billion benefit above what Korea gets from the FTA. Now, the reason why Korea pursued an FTA with the United States is essentially the medium and long term. It's not the immediate tariff reductions in the United States, which aren't that high. It's what it will do and help to transform the Korean economy. Now, during the negotiations, one of the things that I actually found refreshing that the Korean government was fairly open on was that one of their primary goals for the FTA was to take and open up Korea's services market. Now, I've had this conversation with a few Korean academics who didn't really see this as an optimal policy. From an economics perspective, their argument is, we all agree we need to reform the Korean service sector. Why not take and just do unilateral opening? Then you don't have to negotiate the FTA with the United States. You reform the services sector, and we're all happy. Well, this is where I guess the politician in me steps in. The problem with that perspective is that's all great from an economic standpoint of view, and they're right. That probably is the most optimal way to do it. But politically, it's a horrible way to do it. The reality is if you're a politician and you're sitting there looking at either keeping control of your legislature, taking, winning an election, how would you go about this? If you open up unilaterally, your argument to your constituents is, well, we're not going to benefit immediately. There's actually going to be pain. People will probably lose jobs as we restructure. But in the long run, our companies will be better off. They'll be more competitive internationally. And this will work out for us in the end. Probably not the best sales pitch for a politician. Now, on the flip side, if you open up to a large service economy like the United States, the EU, your pitch argument can be, yes, we're opening up the services market, but I'm getting you access on this. We're going to sell more autos in the United States. We're going to sell more autos in the EU. We're going to sell more refrigerators. We're going to sell more mobile phones. Whatever product you want to pick, you can trade it off. So now you have a plus-benefit relationship in terms of the political side of this. And so, you know, this is a major reason why Korea took and has taken this path. They've reached a situation to where they realized that basically they had taken manufacturing development as far as they could and that they had to move into a more modern service-oriented economy and that the only way to do that was to open up and introduce competition into the services sector, which was the least efficient part of the Korean economy. So from a political standpoint, the most practical way to do this was through a free trade agreement rather than unilateral. Now, that being said, that's not the only reason Korea pursues FTAs. If we go back and we look at Korea's FTA partners list real quick, and they have FTAs with Chile, Singapore, the European Free Trade Association, ASEAN, and India. Those are all in force. They've concluded agreements with the United States, the EU, and Peru, and they're in negotiations with Canada, Mexico, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Australia, New Zealand, Colombia, Turkey, and they're considering FTAs with, you have the stalled one with Japan, they're likely to start one with China early next year. They're considering doing a China-Japan-Korea FTA, doing one with Mercosur. Now that we saw the announcement the other day that Russia will likely join the WTO probably sometime in the next 2 to 4 months, if you believe the Russian estimates, they'd be considering doing a Russian one. I've had conversations with officials in Korea and the Russian essentially, the WTO was essentially the one stopping block to them doing an FTA with Russia, Israel, and then the South African Customs Union. So, fairly large list. We had Jeff Schott here a couple weeks ago to do an event, and he pointed out that within a short time, 54% of Korea's trade would be covered by FTAs, and that if the U.S. FTA, the EU, and a few others were concluded and finalized, that would rise up into the 80% level. So you have a significant expansion, and if you look at the list of countries, if you're looking for a growing, large, developing market, India, China, they're both on this list, Mercosur. If you're looking for, you know, access to resources, which not only does Korea lack arable land, they have no natural gas or oil, essentially not many raw materials, most of the natural resources in Korea are in North Korea, actually. So Peru, who they just concluded one with, actually is top three in the world resources in zinc, copper, and tin. So they're touching base on resource access. The Gulf Cooperation Council, obviously, we're talking about oil. If you look at advanced large markets, the United States, the EU, so pretty much all the box you might check if you're asking why or what would the country look for in terms of an FTA, they're checking. Now, the question, though, becomes then still, what pushed Korea, if they hadn't done FTAs up till 2003, to do this? And I think some of this goes back to, if you look actually at the very nature of the Doha Round itself, it was focused on development. Korea was, at that point, still considered a developing country, but was rapidly moving out of that phase. And it was primarily focused on agriculture, which has very little benefit to the Korean economy other than what it needs to import. So the multilateral round wasn't really focusing or conducive on what Korea needed to take and expand, given its dependence on trade. At the same time, they had opened up relations in the late 90s with China, and China was rapidly becoming, and now is Korea's, by significant margin, largest trading partner. So they're also looking for a way to diversify markets, not be tied into simply one market, be it the United States, be it China. So if we look at overall what Korea has done and where they've gone, I think that there's essentially five reasons or five motivations I would give for why Korea is pursuing FTAs. Diversify its export markets, domestic economic reform, access to needed resources, be they food, raw materials, or other. It's necessary for continued economic growth. With a population of 55 million, you're not going to reach, or sorry, less than 50 million, you're not going to reach economies of scale. You need market access elsewhere. And the international system ultimately wasn't providing what Korea needed, and this was a path to take and reach and achieve its goals. And with that, I will turn it back over to Jay.
Troy, thanks very much. That was really very, very enlightening. Next on the panel is Kathy Raper. Kathy's sort of new to Washington, having just joined us from Sydney, where she completed a stint as the deputy TPP negotiator. She is, in her current capacity, Minister Counselor for Trade at the Embassy of Australia. She's responsible for oversight of U.S.-Australia trade relations and represents the Government of Australia on all trade policy matters, including the TPP, the Doha Round, climate change, and other trade-related issues. As I said, immediately prior to her posting in Washington, Kathy was the Assistant Secretary Trade Commitments Branch at DFAT and was responsible, among other things, for the TPP negotiations, where she was the Deputy Chief Negotiator. Earlier in her career, she was posted to Australia's mission to the WTO in Geneva, where she covered WTO dispute settlement and trade and environmental issues. And we're really thrilled that she could join us here today to talk about Australia's trade policy and the proliferation of trade agreements by the Government of Australia. Yours.
Thank you very much, Jay. As Jay says, I'm a relative newcomer to town. I've been here only 6 weeks, so I see many faces around the room that I haven't met, a few that I have met. But it's very, I very much appreciate the chance to address an audience such as this today. And when Judge offered me the opportunity to speak, I was very ready to take it up. Now, I must start, of course, with the advertisement that Jay predicted I would, in saying that at any seminar on FTAs, I have to say outright that for the Australian government, the Doha Round remains our number one trade priority. And it's not just an advertising cliche, it's the fact that we place a lot of store in, a tremendous amount of store in securing a balanced and ambitious conclusion to the Doha Round. And while it has its ups and downs, we just think it's too important not to keep pushing away at, pulling away at, and as a government we're always trying to be active and looking at ways that we can build some momentum into that process, and currently we're feeling more optimistic than not that there might be a way forward on the Doha Round in the next 12 months or so, but we're not here to talk about that today, so but I had to say that outright. It's also true to say that Australia was in some ways a latecomer to the FTA scene, much like Korea. We didn't really get active on FTAs, with one notable exception, and that's our agreement with New Zealand, until the early 2000s, 2002, 2003. We have had a long-standing free trade agreement with New Zealand. Some of you may have heard of the Closer Economic Relations Agreement that we have in New Zealand. That dates back to 1983. And in many ways is a forerunner of the modern FTA scene. We added a services protocol in 1989 that was done on a negative list basis. So it was one of the, you know, the forerunners of the way that services or comprehensive modern services agreements are pursued today. But it wasn't until around about 2002, 2003 that Australia really got involved in the FTA agenda. And for us, it wasn't a case that we didn't trust or believe in the Dole Round to deliver trade liberalisation. It was just we began to realise that the FTAs offered a very useful supplement if done properly. So for Australia, we sought to seek out FTAs with our regional trading partners, and we were looking for FTAs that were comprehensive and high quality and commercially meaningful and that actually made an addition to trade liberalisation. So we've been, we believe, quite, I don't know if principled is the right word, but we don't do FTAs with just anyone. We'll put as another trophy up in our mantelpiece. We generally go into FTAs expecting to deliver something that's going to be high quality and comprehensive at the end of the day. So our list of FTAs completed is reasonably humble compared to some countries. If you look at Chile, I think, for example, has 54 FTA partners. Not 54 FTAs, but 54 FTA partners. We have six FTAs that are in force for Australia. We, of course, have our bilateral free trade agreement with the United States, which entered into force on the 1st of January 2005. And is an FTA that we're very proud of, that is a high-quality agreement that we believe has created an important economic foundation for the Australia-US trading relationship. And much in the way that Troy was saying, really offers an opportunity for a new level of economic and trade integration between our economies that we think has served us both well. We also have free trade agreements with Thailand, with Singapore, with Chile. And most recently, we completed a free trade agreement last year with ASEAN and New Zealand, so the Australia-ASEAN-New Zealand free trade agreement. As I said, I've only been here a short time, but I get the feeling that that agreement probably hasn't got a lot of profile here in Washington, but it's an FTA that we're proud of. We see it as an important connection, a way of integrating our economies more effectively with the ASEAN region. And it's delivered a number of firsts for ASEAN countries. It's the first FTA that they've completed, which has chapters on. Let me get this right. Sorry, I should have had my notes more organised before I came here. It's the first time that an ASEAN FTA has included chapters on investment, intellectual property, competition policy, and e-commerce. It's also help persuade ASEANs to develop the change of tariff classification approach, C2C approach to rules of origin. We have a co-equal approach in the Australia-ASEAN-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, so both the value-added and the change of tariff classification approach operate alongside each other. But that was the first time that a trading partner had convinced our ASEAN trading partners that this might be a valid approach to look at. We also have a very active, ongoing FTA negotiating agenda. We've got seven FTA negotiations underway with all our North Asian trading partners, so China and Japan and Korea. We also have a FTA negotiation with the Gulf Cooperation Council. Bilaterally with Malaysia, where we're looking to build on outcomes achieved for our ASEAN agreement. We also have our negotiation with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, one very dear to my heart, having worked on it in Canberra directly before coming here, and one that I can come back to. We're also engaged in a trade negotiation with the Pacific Island Forum States, that's known as PACER Plus. That's at its heart a trade agreement, but less of a traditional trade agreement. It's also going to have a very strong economic development proportion to it. We're also considering negotiations with India and with Indonesia, but in neither case have we formally launched negotiations at that with either of those partners, but we have completed feasibility studies with both India and with Indonesia. So Judge asked me to talk a little bit about why Australia does FTAs, and I thought I'd just sort of run through how we see it. I mean, some of these arguments, I think, are common in the whole FTA versus WTO, stumbling blocks or building blocks argument that I think were all common in the literature. But nonetheless, I'll give you a quick snapshot on why we do them, once again stressing that it is a supplement to our Doha Round efforts. We think that they do offer the opportunity to deliver economic benefits to our industry more quickly than is currently possible through the WTO round. We see them as an opportunity to tackle more specific issues in depth and often at a high level ambition that's been possible in the WTO. An example there is investment, where the attempt to get an investment negotiation going in the WTO, as we all know, was unsuccessful, albeit is covered by the Mode 3 area of delivery to some extent, the services negotiation. So it's really been in the FTA scene that investment, market access and protections have been taken forward. We see that FTAs offer an opportunity to push the agenda in topics that are already in the WTO, an example there being intellectual property and also on trade and services. And they also allow the opportunity to take up trade-related issues, once again, where the WTO has not been able to agree to do so, and competition policy is another example there. There is an element of needing to keep an eye on the neighbours, and there it does help secure our competitiveness in our key export markets, where other countries are also busily negotiating their FTAs. I've heard the expression said that standing still is going backwards to some extent, so there is an element of that certainly. And we also see FTAs as acting as a vehicle for promoting further extension of trade liberalisation in a variety of contexts. So we see FTAs as having an important building block for contributing to further liberalisation. And I think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, is an example of that, where a lot of the countries involved in the TPP already have FTAs with each other and are now looking for the opportunity to build upon those pre-existing FTAs and create something that is more regional, that is more comprehensive, and that delivers more effectively for our businesses across the region. So without those earlier FTAs, the TPP would have been a step harder, but the earlier FTAs we've done provided a strong foundation for the tasks that we're engaged in now. For Australia too, we look in our FTAs to provide the opportunity for the extension of the liberalisation that we create in them on an MFM basis. We never look in our FTAs to lock in preferential margins of competitors, and it's often the case that outcomes achieved in our FTAs are introduced on a multilateral basis. For example, in competition policy or intellectual property, we've always implemented our FTA commitments on a horizontal basis. We look for FTAs that are ambitious. For us, an FTA means the elimination of all tariffs and quotas on trade, and that is what Australia looks for in our FTAs. It's not always possible. I mean, it is a negotiation at the end of the day, but certainly we set out in an FTA looking for elimination across the board and have achieved that in most of our FTAs to date. Our FTAs, with Singapore and with Thailand and with Chile all go to zero at the end of the implementation periods. With the US, we go to zero, unfortunately, as everyone will know around the room. The US doesn't quite get there on a key commodity, but, that's how it is. Once again, on our agreement with ASEAN, we're achieving very high degrees of trade liberalisation, well into the 90s for 90% for everyone. I think I might leave it there if that's okay, but I certainly can come back and talk about any of our particular FTA negotiations in more detail. Might just briefly mention, given that we're here at the Korea Economic Institute, that Australia is very actively engaged in the FTA negotiation with Korea. Our negotiation is well advanced, and both sides are very engaged and politically committed to concluding a deal. We don't have a particular time frame on that, but we're making very good progress, so I'd be hopeful that we'd have something sooner rather than later. And once again, both sides are committed to producing an FTA that truly is comprehensive and high quality. Anyway, thank you.
Kathy, thanks very much. Cleanup in today's agenda goes to Ray Hearn of CRS. Ray's a specialist in the international trade, specializing in international trade and finance at CRS, and provides research in those areas to Congress on a broad array of trade and international economic issues. He's had a long and distinguished career at CRS, starting in 1975 in its economic division, and moving at various points to the Foreign Affairs and National Defense Division, and then serving as head of the International Trade and Finance Section. In the 90s, he was also detailed to USTR as Director of Trade and Strategy in the Japan Office. Importantly, Ray has authored numerous reports on bilateral and multilateral trade issues. Most importantly and relevant for today's discussion, two reports, one entitled Future of the Eurozone and U.S. Interests, and a second, Europe's Preferential Trade Agreement Status, Content, and Implications, appended to the material provided by Judge today. So Ray's going to focus on the EU's liberalization efforts and proliferation of FTAs, and Ray, we very much look forward to your comments. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you, Jay. And thank you, Judge, for the invitation. It was an interesting FTAs and the invisible hand, an interesting way of titling this session. I don't know if you had a movie in mind or not. But for those of you that thought that maybe there was going to be a movie, I hate to disappoint you. And not only will there not be a movie, I don't have any overheads or a PowerPoint. But
we could put a movie up there if you'd like. So.
Well, no. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to abuse you the old-fashioned way, and you're going to have to look at some tables and charts that are part of a report I produce for the CRS, which I probably should add is a part of the Library of Congress, and we do work for the Congress on a nonpartisan basis, and we try to be as objective as possible in our research, and we don't advocate policies one way or the other. So I have to say that. That's not right. Two of my colleagues are here, and I'm sure they're going to report back if I didn't say that. Based on this report I produced that came out early this year, I'm going to share with you 5 points that I've gone back and feel are worth elaborating on, and I bet that after dinner tonight most of you probably won't be able to remember but one or two of the points I'm going to share with you right now. And by halftime of next week's game between the Redskins and the Bills, I would bet most of you will have forgotten all the points. But I do hope that you'll remember one thing. I had 5 points. That's all. All right. So the first point is that the European Union, or the EU, has the largest network of preferential trade agreements in the world. The EU itself is a preferential trade agreement, the first one that was reported to the GATT in the mid-1950s. The second point is that the EU's network of preferential trade agreements historically has been motivated by a combination of political and economic objectives, but today's generation of FTAs are more squarely focused simply on economic objectives, commercial objectives. Thirdly, the EU's free trade agreements in recent years have been much more similar to U.S. free trade agreements in terms of scope and provisions. The fourth point is that concerns about falling behind and avoiding trade diversion have been a factor in both the efforts of the United States and the EU to negotiate separate but similar free trade agreements with 5 trading partners, namely Israel, Mexico, Morocco, Chile, and Jordan. But neither the United States nor the EU has had much success in improving their share of the market of these countries' import market share. And then my final point is that the EU's preferential trade agreements in the past have only had a small impact on U.S. trade policy and U.S. trade interests. But in today's environment, where certainly the consensus about U.S. free trade agreement policy is in flux, the EU's new free trade agreement with South Korea and its FTA, possible FTA with Canada, could have a much greater impact on U.S. trade interests in the future. So what I want to do now is to really abuse you and ask you to turn in your handout to which should be...
It's the first page past the participants.
Table 3.
Right.
And what I'd like to do is just briefly elaborate on each of these points. regarding the first point, that the EU is the largest network of ETAs in the world. So if you look at Table 3, it's entitled EU 27 Trade Covered by PTAs, and look at row 28, which shows that EU's trade agreements notified to the WTO as of 2008 were valued at $511 billion and represented 27% of EU exports to the world. And on the next page, row 37, shows that 3.4 trillion in trade is covered by a combination of extra EU exports as well as intra EU exports, accounting for 70% of total EU exports. Now, the inclusion of intra-EU trade, which is basically, say, Germany's exports to France or France's exports to Germany, I think can be justified because the EU, as I said, is a preferential trade agreement that discriminates against non-members. In contrast, if you look at the next table, Table 4, in U.S. trade covered by PTAs, you can see in row 18, glad to hear the paper's turning. That means that you're listening. 40% of total U.S. exports are covered by PTAs or FTAs, accounting for some $520 billion in exports. So based on these figures, I think an argument can be made that U.S. firms face more discrimination, possibly reduce sales due to the EU's larger network of preferential trade agreements. So turning to my next point, and then please turn the page. The next point is dealing with the EU's network of preferential trade agreements and how the motivation over time has changed, where it had a combination of economic and political objectives, and now it's much more focused on opening markets. Table A1 provides a list of EU PTAs with future members and close neighbors, where here the objective of the EU has been to prepare countries for accession to the EU or some looser relationship. Table A2 includes PTAs with bordering or near-bordering countries. And this is the category where the EU obviously cares mostly about political stability. Table A3 includes PTAs with developing countries where the motivation of the EU is driven by its historical preference programs and colonial relationships. And then finally, we get to point to Table A4, and I should say that in the three previous categories, the market opening has been only a modest, I think, ambition of the EU. When we get to Table A4, and we have the list of EU PTAs with distant countries and regions, here the emphasis is more squarely on obtaining commercial objectives. And that is to say, to neutralize discrimination that EU companies may be faced because of the proliferation of PTAs around the world, and also motivated to open up markets for EU companies. Now, I'll just elaborate on my third point, which is that the EU's free trade agreements have become much more similar to U.S. free trade agreements in scope and provisions in recent years. And here we can distinguish between WTO plus provisions and WTO extra provisions. So that would be the table one, which is page 15 of the report, provides a list of so-called WTO plus provisions where the U.S. and EU undertake FTA commitments that build on or deepen already existing WTO commitments. As many of you know, these FTA agreements are hundreds of pages long and steeped in legalese, so to actually go through and try to compare just two FTAs is a heck of an undertaking, but researchers at the Bruegel Institute in Brussels and at LSE, Troy's alma mater, have done that, and they found broad similarities between the U.S. and EU FTAs. Perhaps they argue there's been a bit more ambition on the part of the United States in area of services, IPR, intellectual property protection, and trade-related investment. Of course, under Lisbon Treaty, the Commission have the jurisdiction over investment that it didn't have in those days, so that that could change. Table 2 deals with what we call WTO extra provisions. So this is the area that can be defined as commitments and policy areas not currently covered or regulated by the WTO. Here we find, at least the Bruegel and LSE researchers have found, a tendency for the EU FTAs to incorporate some of these WTO extra provisions more frequently than the U.S. has done in its FTAs. So the EU agreements, for example, have incorporated provisions on competition policy, social matters, illegal immigration, and terrorism, while the United States has looked to focus on anti-corruption, environment, and labor. And I must say that very few of these provisions on either side are legally enforceable. So they're more stretching out into areas that both sides would like to be eventually on the agenda, perhaps in Doha. Now, turning to my fourth point, I'm going to just ask you to glance at figures 1 through 5 and sort of stare at the lines and how they go up and down. I'm not going to go into each of these figures and abuse you any further, but these figures deal with both U.S. and EU concerns about falling behind or avoiding a trade diversion as a factor in their efforts to negotiate and then implement a separate but similar FTAs with these five countries, Israel, Mexico, Morocco, Chile, and Jordan. These figures, 1 to 5, I think, provide data indicating that neither side has really gained market share as a result of implementation of an FTA. Now, that doesn't mean that individual companies aren't benefiting, obviously, and I have some thoughts as to why this may be the case. We can go into that later. Only in the case of Morocco, which is figure 5, have the implementation of an FTA actually coincided with a small rise in market share for both the United States and the EU. Now, the final point I want to emphasize is that the EU's FTA with South Korea and its ongoing negotiations with Canada over a comprehensive FTA certainly can affect and influence U.S. trade interests in any future debate about our free FTA policy in a significant fashion, I think. Most EU FTA partners in the past have been small developing countries, and they've accounted for a small share of EU exports. But South Korea and Canada are much larger markets with the potential to really generate some trade diversion. In the case of South Korea, as many of you know, various studies have estimated the adverse impact on U.S. exports and employment to be quite significant if CORUS is not implemented. In the case of Canada, if the EU reaches a comprehensive FTA, then the EU and the United States would have an FTA with Canada and Mexico, making the absence of an FTA between the United States and Europe all the more glaring after so many years of discussion. But it's not clear where EU policy is headed. Besides the United States, there are only a few remaining developed countries that the EU can try to negotiate with, such as Australia, China, and Japan. And these are the countries that fall outside of the EU's network of preferential agreements. While FTAs with these countries would yield large economic benefits, some of these countries are likely to demand liberalization of European agriculture and services. These are areas, of course, where there is, might be some European opposition. So I'll just end on a safe note by stating the obvious. The future direction of the EU's FTA policy is uncertain, and its impact on U.S. FTA policy is uncertain, even with the help of the invisible hand.
Thanks, Ray. I guess I'm going to take the we're now going to open it up to questions. I'm going to take moderator's prerogative, I guess, and pose the first question, unless our sponsor wants to.
You go ahead, Jay.
Ray, I guess I'd like to come back to you on just a point on CORUS and maybe draw Troy into this as well. You made the point that if CORUS isn't implemented in the EU FTA with Korea is, that would put U.S. exports at a competitive disadvantage. And I wonder if I could just press that sort of one step farther down the line, which is to hypothesize that the EU, that eventually CORUS does go into force, but after the EU Korea FTA does. And I wonder, at least I've heard from some business leaders that if the EU, their agreement with the EU goes into force first, that will trigger a whole series of business sourcing contract decisions and so forth that would be very deleterious to long-term U.S. Korea trade trends, even if CORUS is implemented. And I wonder if you've looked into that, Troy, any comments you might have about that?
I haven't looked into it, but it certainly seems plausible that if EU service providers and get into the market first and wrap up or tie up the best distribution networks and make alliances with Korean distributors, that would certainly be more than a short-term problem for our service providers. Similarly, you get goods in the market that are able to gain market share immediately. That does make a difference. Is it reversible in the long run? Well, no, nothing is. But in the short run, I would agree with people on our side that are making that argument.
Yeah, I guess I would just make a few comments. One, I think there's some legitimacy to that concern, but I think the issue is we know the EU FTA, barring something unforeseen, is going to go into effect July 1 of next year. So the question I think rises if you're a Korean who's looking to do business with either the EU or the US is when will CORUS go into effect? If we know that the agreement is submitted early next year, and we know that from vote counts it's an easy pass, which, doesn't look like it'll be likely, but if there was some certainty that the CORUS FTA would go into effect shortly thereafter, I think that might become less of an issue. If there's still doubt, which I think is likely in terms of when a vote will be and when implementation will be, I think that's a road that, might actually happen. And one of the examples I think we can look at in terms of, there's two examples. One, the U.S., and I don't remember the details of the numbers on wine specifically, used to have a fairly solid position on wine in Korea, and then Korea did an FTA with Chile, and now Chile is one of the more dominant sellers of wine in the Korean market. The other one is beef. What was interesting to me about beef, and this might be both a representation of the problem and the long-term hope, one of your CRS colleagues, Remy Duranis, had a chart that I saw that was interesting, which was
If you look at before BSE, it was about 800 metric tons that the U.S. was selling in Korea. But a couple of years before that, it was actually only 400 metric tons or so. And we're back up to that 400 metric ton mark. So the question I have not found the answer to yet is, what led to the large surge? And so we may not ever get back to that 800 point, but I think you can get back to a much more sustainable level. But so, you know, I think that there's some doubt here, but there's also some hope as well.
Thanks, Troy. Okay, I guess I'd like to throw it open to everybody. If you could just raise your hand, and when I call on you, just introduce yourself and identify the organization that you're affiliated with. Thanks.
Larry Bruiser, Mitsui USA. This is a question for Ms. Raper. Based on your experience with TPP, how would you assess the degree of energy and commitment the Obama administration is bringing to trade liberalization? How would you assess the extent of energy and commitment in the Obama administration to the goal of trade liberalization?
Sure. That's a very good question. I think I'll answer it by saying that in my experience on the TPP, there is great commitment and enthusiasm for that negotiation of the U.S. administration. Certainly, the U.S. has committed strong resources to it and some of the first-time negotiators to it, and is putting a lot of energy in the last year to reaching out to stakeholders across the business. I think in terms of moving forward, we're all committed to make maximum headway on the TPP, and that's translated into four rounds this year, including round five or six next year. So the fact that we're scheduled out there into well into 2011 series of rounds. Energy to the bilateral discussion. Certainly there I don't sense any of that. You know, at the same time, I agree with you as Ms. Jones has said that what happens next week, of course, is important.
Yes, Ms.
Thanks, Jay. I'm Joanne Thornton with Concept Capital Washington Research Group, and I'm not to keep beating up on Kathy or to have you monopolize, but I'd like to follow up on Larry's question a little, and maybe, Jay, you have some things to say here, too. Again, on the TPP, the Obama administration has approached this as an opportunity to negotiate what they call a 21st century free trade agreement, something new and different. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, what's new and different that the U.S. is bringing to this that also has found acceptance by Australia and other negotiating partners? And did Australia also have this type of goal in going in for the TPP and not just to sort of maximize and harmonize relationships in the region, but also to go about this in a different way? And how? Thanks.
Thank you. I would say I can certainly speak on behalf of the Australian government with certainty, but I think I'd also be speaking on behalf of all the technical partners in saying that the commitment to delivering what we're calling a 21st century agreement is across the board. And what I guess that means, to put into more detail, is that we're looking to do traditional trade issues in new and better ways. We're also looking to tackle topics that haven't necessarily been tackled in NTO. So I'll give you some examples. a big theme of the TPP, otherwise we're trying to have regulatory coherence. So traditionally, FTAs have chapters on and have looked at ways of encouraging above and beyond the WTO TPT agreement, ways that you can have greater recognition and equivalence of standards. They've only made a little bit of progress that's possible made. But we're also looking at whether you can extend what's traditionally been seen as a product standard area into other areas in the UK. For example, if you can come up with some principles that achieve better regulatory coherence in the product standards side of things, you can then apply that to the services sector. If you look at how that might apply in the environmental sector. So it's looking at ways that you can take approaches that have been used, strengthen them, and then apply them across the other examples that we're looking at are topics about SMEs. Now, there's nothing in FTAs that have been included today that in any way cut across SMEs and then for all business interests. But there's a perception that perhaps SMEs aren't engaging with FTAs as strongly as they could. And maybe SMEs have different issues or different barriers they encounter in markets. So particularly parties have agreed to So in my previous role as Deputy Chief Negotiator, I spent a lot of time talking to Australian business and saying, okay, interested in hearing from the SMEs and whether your issues are different. So what can we do? So there's been a lot of time spent exploring themes such as that. There are other examples of competitiveness amongst the countries in the TPP and how we could look to minimise trade diversion amongst the group to put everyone on a more competitive footing. We're approaching this as a living agreement, one that can adapt and take on new things, not be static from the day it's given. Another example is development. We have developing members of the organisation. So one thing has been to look particularly at what we can do to deliver their needs. And in approaching the TPP, we've all been agreed, but we'll be approaching it as a high-quality agreement. And not with respect to putting in place any special treatment for developing countries that must be able to go. But at the same time, part of that equation, so to speak, is to be able to deliver capacity building and the assistance to the developing economies so that they can on that same level. Anyway, those are a few examples, but I just wanted to say there is some meat behind the 21st century label. A lot of that is what the parties are busy fleshing out at the moment. So it's only round three. I don't think we can expect fully fledged answers right at the outset. But what's encouraging is that there's a little bit of things to talk about and address some of these issues.
Maybe I could just add two comments, if I could, to Kathy's. The first is among the other issues that are being discussed is supply chain. There's a supply chain task force. And one of the issues that was that I dealt with when I was at USTR years ago, when we were first dealing sort of in the concept phase of the TPP, was, this dovetails with the focus on the benefits to SMEs, is for a GE or a Boeing, they've got the wherewithal to invest billions of dollars a year in their own supply chain security, but there are plenty of mid-sized and smaller companies that really don't have the financial wherewithal to be able to do that. And it makes it more costly for them to utilize these agreements if they don't have those supply chain systems in place. So another aspect of the agreement that the negotiators are looking at is how to sort of streamline and harmonize some of the supply chain standards in the countries among the TPP members, the customs procedures, how to streamline those to ensure that the benefits are sort of not just horizontal, but vertical as well, so that it's not just the BHPs of the world or the GEs of the world that benefit from the agreement, but that the benefits permeate sort of deep into the economies of the TPP members. And certainly, one way to unlock those benefits is to make access to the agreement and utilization of the agreement more user friendly. And the second thing to keep in mind about the TPP generally, and I don't think this is a point that has been made yet, is that I guess it has in the sense that this is supposed to be a living agreement, but not just in terms of modifying the agreement, but in terms of building a really sturdy foundation upon which can be built an eventual free trade agreement of the Asia-Pacific. I mean, this is not meant to be only an agreement between the 8 TPP partners. And frankly, if that were the only level of ambition, then I don't think there'd be nearly the support for it among the U.S. business community that there is. But the concept is that it's the starting point for what will be a really super FTA between, you know, the U.S. and including all, you know, eventually all the ASEAN countries and others. And I mean, that is the level of ambition. That's what makes it. That's also part of what makes it so ambitious, so difficult, so challenging. Because it needs to be constructed in such a way that you don't have to, that a newly acceding country wouldn't require the current members to you know, resubmit the agreement to their Congress or their parliament, for example, for ratification. Those are all issues that are going to have to be worked out over the course of the negotiations. But the key is to build a really strong foundation on which a long-term, really broad agreement can be built.
Okay, I just wanted to, because I'm not sure whether anybody knows the answer to either one of them, that's my excuse for trying to put two questions into the one here. Kathy, I believe it was you who talked a little bit about things that you weren't able to achieve, whether the WTO wasn't taking up like investment and so forth. And that's sort of a lead into question one, which is that there's some things which are under discussion in the WTO, but people haven't come to any agreement on. I'm thinking of GIs, for example, geographical indications. And I don't know the answer here. I've been told, I've known this only at the sort of rumor level, that the EU agreement does have some provisions in the EU-Korea agreement affecting GIs. So my first question is whether that's an issue which Australia has a view on, and would it be... How would it affect your negotiations with Korea? And then the second question is a TPTP question, which is, do the people who are following it, and I don't really, not close enough, but of all of you folks, have views as to its expansion? I mean, one country that's frequently mentioned as a possible addition is Canada, and so I'd just be interested in how people see the idea of expanding the list of negotiating countries. Those are the two questions.
You were the deputy chief.
We'll take the TPP first. Thank you, Judge. I'm hanging my head in shame here that they have to come to the very obvious point that I should have mentioned earlier, is that one of the TPP strengths is that it's been designed from the very beginning to grow. So it's not being set up as an agreement amongst just the current parties, but it's been designed as something that's open to anyone who's willing to sign up to the same high-level, high-quality conference that gives it the place themselves. And because of that, getting the structure right of the agreement is very important. So a lot of the early discussions have been how we actually structure the market access of the TPP in a way that, A, has been the prior agreements bilateral context, but B also is most bringing in in that respect, there is a tension between timing and growth to some extent, and with the timing mark on November, there is a sense of amongst two parties that any members that are coming in this stage need to come to this. So in that respect, I know there is a lot of interest out there in the TPP. And we certainly very much welcome that interest. There's a lot of engagement going on with other interested countries. That engagement is at several different levels. So there are some countries that are very close to becoming, making a formal decision to join. There are others who just want to know what's going on. Engagement happens at all levels. Canada, I know, has been a party that's been talked about, and certainly, you know, me as Australia, I've had discussions with Canada. One of the things about the TPP is that it's not in the gift of any deciding to invite someone else to the table in the last degree, that makes that process a complex one, where there has to be a lot of discussions over an interwoven nature between the parties. So I know that those discussions are ongoing with Canada, and Australia's perspective, we think they will make a useful contribution. The question is the timing when that will happen. I think the space to watch is Malaysia. Discussions with Malaysia are at that stage where just about everyone is convinced that Malaysia shares the objectives of the starting aid term. I think there's a good chance that we'll see Malaysia table soon rather than Australia's perspective. Very valuable addition.
Well, I know there are some stuff on GI in the EU, but I'll be honest, it was like October of last year when I started to go into the details. In terms of TPP's long-term expansion, there's been some debate, and I mean, in DC, you know, there's the Fred Burson, you know, frame of thought, which is that it needs to be and he's actually said a less than U.S. FTA standard agreement to be as wide as possible and draw people in. You know, I've talked to some other colleagues who I won't name their embassies, but who they're like, no, this has to be really high level. We want to set a very high standard so that when people come in, we have a good agreement. I won't necessarily place a value judgment on either of those, but the one thing that I will say is I think in terms of long-term expansion, there's two things that need to be put into consideration, well, maybe three things that need to be put into consideration. One, you know, right now, I remember Senator Levin made a comment. I think he said that the TPP would be the United States' ninth largest trading partner if it were to come into effect tomorrow. Korea itself is a larger trading partner than the TPP right now. The reason I mentioned that isn't necessarily to promote Korea in and of itself, but is to say that for the TPP to work, I mean, I think this, what we really ultimately need is this, what I call the centrifugal force. You know, what will give the agreement enough mass, enough partners in terms of trade, you know, standards and everything, that it'll basically draw others into where countries will sit there and it really will be a question, okay, can we afford to stay out of this or do we have to get in? So that's the first thing. It's sort of, you know, I don't think anybody would say right now that the TPP is at the point where you have that centrifugal force to where it will draw everyone within the region in, or at least start to draw them in, per se. The other thing is, and this is sort of, I guess two halves are really one point. You know, I've talked with some people in Korea before, and you know, their concern with the TPP, they'll say, is that, well, it's primarily an agricultural agreement. Now, whether they seriously think that or not may be another issue. But what I think it raises is that, you know, there will be a different level in terms of the countries coming in, both in terms of the development and other things. And I know in terms of the TPP right now, you have, you know, with Vietnam and some others, some very different levels of development. But I think there's going to be some unique issues that need to be worked through. And so when you consider expansion is how do you take and create a high-level agreement that might either address those or not, you know, basically essentially exclude countries because they say, all right, we'd love to be part, but we're not willing to go down that road. And, you know, the one long-term question, I think, because if you get this centrifugal force and you draw people in, at some point, the issue that is going to come up is China. You know, if China wants in or if China sees it as a threat. And I guess the question is if China decides they want in, my guess is that China will not join on the terms of everyone else. So, you know, there will probably have to be some type of exceptions for China. And the U.S. may even want some exceptions for China for other reasons. So I mean, these are some of the things, I mean, at least when I try to look at TPP, where it's going, that I think, you know, long term, not necessarily maybe the stage right now. I mean, they need to be thought about and they need to be fleshed out so you get the initial stage right and then you can move forward.
Could I just add a couple of points to Troy's? One is that I take the point that there needs to be a critical mass, and I think that one of the more exciting developments in the TPP in the last couple of months is the growing enthusiasm and support for Malaysia joining, and I think that it's all but certain, unless there's some really unforeseen event, it's all but certain that either sometime during Brunei or before the New Zealand round, that they'll probably join and take a full a seat at the table. And I think then you really are close to that critical mass. And I think that the joining of Malaysia also has an additional benefit from the standpoint of U.S., not just the U.S. economic interest, but sort of geostrategic interests. You're talking about a moderate Muslim country in Southeast Asia. There's all sorts of additional benefits beyond just economic that are to be gained by Malaysia joining. That was just the one.
I had a question. Just from a congressional perspective, I'm wondering how far the administration and USTR can go down this road of engaging in the TPP process without Trade Promotion Authority. At what point does the administration have to go to the Hill?
Well, legally there's nothing preventing them from going all the way up to concluding agreement until they are ready to submit a final finished agreement up to the Hill. I mean, there's no reason that they their negotiating posture should be constrained during the negotiations. You don't need TPA to conclude the TPP, and you really only need it once you've got an agreement ready to go. And I mean, I agree, at that point you absolutely have to have TPA or some version of fast track authority, but you certainly don't need it to authorize the.
But conversely, I mean, are the negotiating partners taking our negotiating stance seriously? I mean, if we can't deliver them?
Let's have Kathy.
Firsthand. I knew that question was coming to you. Well, I mean, I agree with Jay. I think you want it probably somewhere midway down the road, just because the further you get down the road, the more any vote on TPA essentially becomes a proxy vote on TPP. So you might be less likely to get it the further you get down the road if people have concerns. So that would be my only thing. No, you don't need it, but it would be wise to have it for that reason.
And certainly at this stage in negotiation, it's not something for Australia or the other negotiation. We see evidence of the administration's negotiation. From my perspective as an outsider, it seems that the administration has working to domestic conduct itself as if it had TPA. So I guess the thought is when it does get to the point of seeking that homework that's provided will hopefully be recognised and evaluated.
John Magnus with Miller and Chevalier. Maybe a question on a lighter note. Terminology. MFN has been renamed, Fast Track has been renamed. Now you're talking about something for which there's this unbelievable proliferation of, you know, there's PTAs and FTAs and EPAs and God only knows what else. Is there, for any of you, sort of a preferred sort of terminology? And does it matter that the U.S. government can't seem to bring itself to refer to the TPP as a free trade agreement negotiation? Is there any significance to that?
Don't see any myself. I mean, in the WTO, as you might know, they're called RTAs, regional trade agreements, and I always think that's, if in doubt, that's the easiest expression to use, but it's the authorized one.
But it's more obscure. It doesn't tell what's actually being negotiated, regional trade agreements.
Or what the final objective is.
Yeah.
It doesn't pre-stage the final objective the way FTAs.
But anything with free trade in it is toxic to many members of Congress, especially.
Plus, I think we have an alphabet soup industry in town, so it can be frustrating because you can be talking to somebody and you'll use one term and they'll be like, oh, wait, you mean this? And you're like, oh, yes, or, you know, but.
So who's going to deliver us from this mess?
The animals.
I mean, the TPP can rightly be called, I think, a regional trade agreement in all sense. So I think that works for people. We're happy to run with it. Equally within our system, we have no problems.
But actually, if I can just chime in here, but not with any clarity, just with further confusion on my part, that is, I've taken an interest in the last couple of days in this negotiation, which seems to have been complete between Japan and India. And that seems to be labeled an economic partnership agreement, which is a coverall for, within which an FTA is nested. That's the way it's described sometimes. But I'm not sure what the rest of the agreement is. And so, I mean, that's why it's an expression of confusion here. But, I mean, a lot of people are using different things because they're covering more And that's part of the problem or the issue. By the way, I think that agreement is particularly, there are our little TikTok quotes in here about it, but there was a fascinating Japanese article, the essence of which is that they're going to eat our lunch in, let's say, Otto's, the Indians, but we still have to be in the market and we still need the FTA now. and it's a sort of a dynamic that we hadn't discussed much today, but is out there.
The only last thing I'd say on your concern about terminology is that, I mean, as much as people may agree that the term free trade is toxic, or specifically the word NAFTA, and you'll hear government officials tell you that, I'm amazed how often you'll hear the phrase, it's our ex since NAFTA. Everything gets referenced to NAFTA, so even things that are toxic still seem to stick around no matter what.
Yeah. Actually, that was, if I could ask one question, or just anybody to comment on it. I was struck by your notion, when you were talking about the Europeans' near agreements, which were done, in a sense, for the sake of political stability. Mm-hmm. People in this room may have forgotten, but when NAFTA was done, the notion of political stability was a very high part of the argument at the time. Of course, here it hasn't worked out so well.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, for the Taurus Agreement, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Secretary of State and Gates show up on the Hill, and they'd be out there selling the agreement in some fashion, because I think the national security card is always going to be played when the votes are tight.
Well, and has that, in fact, already started? I mean, we saw in the wake of the sinking of the Korean frigate.
I mean, you can make the argument that part of Obama's impetus for reaching a decision at the Toronto G20 to take a move course now was the sinking of the Chonan. That yeah. It was sort of rose him to the cause of, okay, yeah. There's a larger relationship here at stake. We have a lot of interests intertwined, and we can't let this simply keep lingering on us.
Go.
Please go right ahead.
I'm Greg Rushford of the Rushford Report. And forgive me, I've been off writing a book, so a lot of this I haven't followed, but I do remember that political stability was promised for Ohio and it didn't work. In Michigan, our third world places, but does the U.S. have a negotiating agenda on TPP? Is there any reason to take it seriously at all here? I mean, we don't want Canada in there because, unlike us, they're not pure free trade in dairy, and, you know, Vietnam sells its catfish and all kinds of toxic things. I mean, where does this pass? Is there a laugh test meter here that, or am I missing something, that this is really serious and they have a negotiating agenda? And,
oh, boy. We on the record, off the record. No.
Well,
I guess it's 4:02. I guess originally I was sort of a skeptic because the Obama administration's trade policy had been sort of hard, not just hard to characterize, but I guess hard to identify, like it wasn't visible. But I actually do think that this TPP initiative is legit. I mean, as Kathy said, there's an enormous amount of resources, human resources, talented trade negotiator hours that are going into planning these rounds, that are going into try to square some of the very difficult issues about the market access modalities and how to make this an agreement that has sort of broader buy-in in the U.S. Not just among, you know, the traditional interests like the business community and the investment community, but among SMEs and so forth. So I really do think that it took, I think candidly, much longer than it should have for the administration to come around to the importance of pursuing this. And I think it also probably came to the realization that, you know, we can't just do enforcement at USTR. It is a trade negotiating agency, so we probably should be negotiating something. And since it's not going to be the Doha round, obviously, should probably be something, and the TPP makes as much sense as anything. I mean, that's a little bit skeptical, but I think there's some grains of truth to that. But I really legitimately think that And I honestly think that that USTR and the White House has made a commitment to this. And, you know, whether it gets done in 2011, I think is anybody's guess. Probably not, but you have to set a sort of ambitious goal. And if you meet it, great. And if not, then the negotiations continue. That's what we have with Korea and the other FTAs that I helped to negotiate. But yeah, I think it's for real. Sorry, we'll just make this the last question.
Oh, I'm Ian Ferguson with CRS. I didn't say that before, but one of the ways that the TPP is being sold is that it is potentially a way to clean out the spaghetti bowl a little bit with agreements with, since we have agreements with numerous countries, Australia has agreements with numerous countries. But in the end of the day, if you don't have a common market access agreement, which does not appear to be a clear and settled situation, how can that be, and how does that work? And if I could ask Ray, too, is what's the EU's record with amalgaming various, have they tried to do something like the TPP in the sense of trying to create a larger agreement where they had several smaller agreements before?
Not recently, as far as I know. I mean, but they do, I mean, they do have a preference for acting regionally because they're in a regional entity themselves, and so they feel better negotiating region to region. But oftentimes they tried doing that with ASEAN, and it failed. The level of development among the countries was too great, and they just couldn't reach a common schedule to move forward on. So they ended that negotiation. But,
I guess these are very important. All the TPP parties do share the objective of untangling the spaghetti bowl, and to deliver something that is truly regional. What that looks like at the end of the day, what we're still working through. We can see Australia can see a lot of traction. There's a lot of discussion happening about what that looks like. So I think at the moment, it's space to watch, and certainly everyone has their goal in mind.
Thanks. Meredith, did you?
A question. You may know this, Jane. Just looking at the U.S.-EU, the EU-Korea FTA, what were the commitments there on standards? I had read at some point that there was some commitments to adopt European standards on the part of Korea. And would that have an effect on this harmonization and rationalization of standards?
You know, I have to confess, I'm not as familiar with the standards part of the EU-Korea FTA as I am some of the other customs and rules of origin parts, and maybe Troy can.
Well, what I do know in terms of standard of that is on the autos, which is what everybody on both sides of the Atlantic is making fun of, Korea agreed to take an harmonized standard with what are technically UN something standards, I forget the exact acronym off the top of my head, but ultimately they come down to the European standards on safety and environmental issues.
For autos,
yeah. And so that was sort of the European solution. If we harmonize, your standards on autos, and it doesn't cover every standard Korea has, it's, I think somebody said it's like 90% of Korea's standards related to autos, but that it would then take and eliminate the whole concern about non-tariff barriers in the Korean market. The EU, I think, is trying to move in that direction. It was interesting. This is even more of a practical point than really a negotiated point. There was an interesting Washington Post article about a week or two ago how there is a German company which sells essentially prefabricated kitchens in China, and the Germans and Europeans are essentially cornering the market on this. And what it means is because they're designing the kitchens in China, because European stoves, refrigerators, everything are smaller than U.S. refrigerators and stoves, that essentially will be shut out of the market in the long run because China will essentially convert to essentially a European standard on a lot of these items. So, I mean, there's the negotiated way, and then there's, you know, more just the practical, this is what the dominant market force is, and so now they've become the standard.
Right, I guess so there's just competition between the U.S. and EU and Asia on enforcement. Thanks, that's helpful.
Thank you all very much for coming. Appreciate your participation.